Welcome to the most important podcast of your financial future. Today, we're going to teach you how to lose money. Pay attention, because these are the most valuable lessons you'll ever learn about creating wealth. Let's get started.
Ponce de Leon set sail from Puerto Rico in 1513 to find the imaginary Fountain of Youth. His absurd quest ultimately failed. Instead, Ponce de Leon wound up discovering Florida and the Yucatan peninsulas. Hi, everyone. I'm Paul Moore.
And I'm Josh Thomas. I actually have been to the Fountain of Youth. It's in St. Augustine, Florida, allegedly. The oldest city in the contiguous U.S., or however they want to define it, the oldest European city, something like that. Really cool place. By the way, this is the podcast for How to Lose Money, and this is where we discuss defining moments of success through distinctive stories of failure with business owners, investors, and entrepreneurs. And I just had to throw that in there, that I've actually been there, and I had actually heard of Ponce de Leon.
I think they might be underwater right now with this flood. I'm not sure, but anyway, so be it. So today our guest is Victor Monash, who's going to tell us how to lose money by allowing government threats to scare you into inaction. Hey, Victor.
Great to be here.
We were trying to find a one-sentence description of this, and I think once we get into the story, everybody will understand that is – that is the best way to describe it. And, you know, before we get into this, Victor, a lot of people are really scared of the government. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. I mean, they hold all the negotiating leverage, and you have to go to them for permission at every step of the way. So they have all of the leverage. And you, as the entrepreneur trying to get things done, trying to make money, they can throw a wrench in your plans at any time.
Yeah, and we've had some guests on here from other countries, and other countries, the bureaucracy is no different. It's just, you know, how much can you pay to have them look the other way? And fortunately or unfortunately, depending on the way that you you look at this, our government doesn't tend to operate that way, at least on the regular person level. When you get up to the gigantic corporations, lobbyists, maybe it's a little bit different. But, you know, the government exists, for the most part, to facilitate and protect us. It just doesn't seem like it always is doing that.
Well, that's true. And, you know, in this particular case, this particular story, we're talking about the use of eminent domain. And eminent domain was originally developed to give government the ability to undertake things for the common good of the community. For example, if you're building a new highway, or you're building an airport or a seaport or something like that. And, you know, here we were in the center of the city of Philadelphia, minding our own business, redeveloping parts of the city that had really fallen into disrepair. And along came this bombshell of the city deciding to expropriate 33 acres in the downtown core, a total of 1,344 properties.
Man, well,
which is a huge, huge undertaking.
Yeah. Well, and we're looking forward to getting into this and seeing what happened. So every failure story we encounter follows a predictable pattern, and because of that, we've developed a marker system with flags, helps keep everyone on track as to where we are. Here's a quick overview. The green flag is our initial part of the story. The red flag is the first sign of trouble. The black flag is the point of no return, where everything is dead. And the white flag signifies total surrender, the moment that we walk away. Paul, can you tell us a little bit about our guest today?
Yeah, Victor Monash spent the first 25 years of his career in the high-tech industry. He started his career at Bell Northern Research in Nortel, where he designed chips that were used to control the telephone network. For approximately a decade, 54% of the phone calls in North America were routed by a chip that Victor designed. He eventually learned to raise capital in technology companies. Now he's the author of the book Magnetic Capital, and he's building multi-million dollar apartment buildings as a real estate developer. So, Victor, I first heard you on the Real Estate Guys podcast, and I think that was maybe where the Magnetic Capital book was birthed, and that's one of the few books on my nightstand right now that I continue to turn to. So thanks for writing that. That's a really important book for me. How did that come into being? How did the book come about?
Well, it's quite funny because I had done this interview with Robert and Russ, the real estate guys, and my business coach listened to an excerpt of the interview before it aired, and he said, "Victor, you've got a book there." And I said, "Yeah, but I'm busy working on another book." He said, no, you got to write this one." So I went home that night and I outlined 13 chapters and I took a look at it and said, "Yeah, he's kind of right." So I made the decision that night to write the book, and I'm glad I did.
Well, thank you for writing it. It surely does fill a niche. I've noticed that there's just not a lot of books about that out there, and it's something that is so important. I mean, as you know, Josh, raising capital, having a capital is the huge Achilles heel for a whole lot of entrepreneurs. And Victor's really nailed it and told us how to do it.
Well, thank you. And the feedback that I've received from readers has been exactly that it's been very helpful to them, that they've learned a lot, things that they maybe understood intuitively but couldn't really crystallize into something that was clear. It put it in language that they could internalize and build some plans around and figure out where they had gaps and how they needed to close the gaps. It really has helped, I think, a lot of entrepreneurs raise money.
So tell us a little bit about some of the lessons that you learned were coming from the experiences that you've had, and take us into this experience that we're going to share today. We're at the Green Flag. You're considering investing or renovating some properties or acquiring some properties. Tell us what's going on before the government comes in.
So we had acquired a total of about 72 properties in the downtown of Philadelphia in an area called North Philly. And we had started redeveloping them with a strategy that we call buy on the line, move the line. And the line is that line, and every city in America has this line, between the hot gentrified neighborhood, and you go two blocks too far and you're in the hood. I know it doesn't matter where you are, if in your own city you can picture this, because every city has one like that. And in Philadelphia, there's a few of those lines. In this particular one, we decided to buy, like I said, about 72 properties just on the wrong side of the line. And we have started redeveloping them. And when you buy things on the wrong side of the line, you're buying things at a huge discount. When you create new product and you put enough scale behind it, that new product becomes quite desirable because you're essentially expanding the gentrified neighborhood. The only comps are in the good neighborhood, not in the hood. So you get huge, huge value creation when you do it that way. And so we had built a number of buildings and had very good success with that. And this was just the latest in a string of projects in this same area. And that's it. That's what we were doing.
It's an interesting concept, and it makes a lot of sense as a developer and as an investor. You're buying the property with the highest probability of increasing in value. And as soon as you said buy on the line and move the line, I knew exactly what you're talking about. I'm here in Austin, Texas.
Yeah, I-35. That used to be the line.
You're exactly right.
Right?
Yep. It split the city right in half, and on the east side, East Austin was the place where you did not go, and everything else was fine.
Yeah, it wasn't until the university built the baseball stadium that people all of a sudden ventured east of I-35, and now that area is hot.
And now all of the cool, hip co-working spaces are in East Austin. I was just looking yesterday, and every single one of them is on the east side, and there's all these crazy hipster restaurants, and, you know, the house values have skyrocketed, but there still is a line. It's just that line is further east now. So I know exactly what you're talking about, and I think everybody can relate to that, especially if you live in a larger city. So tell me, as you're doing this, had you done this type of project before, or was it your first time buying on the line and moving the line?
We started this in 2011, and so we had been doing it for several years and with good success. You know, the basic formula was to create enough value that we could refinance the property once it was leased up and stabilized at 70 or 75% loan to value and recover 100% of our invested capital. And then at that point, you're holding the proverbial no money down deal, property that's generating positive cash flow, but you have no cash tied up in it with a fairly healthy debt to equity ratio.
And so this one went a little bit different because something happened. The first red flag here, was it the state government or the city government? Who was it and what did they say?
It's a process that involved several levels of government and several government agencies. So the actual expropriation of the land was being initiated by the Philadelphia Housing Authority in cooperation with other parts of the city of Philadelphia. At the end of the day, the legislation is passed at the state level. So there was a process that culminated in a state level ordinance, but it started out at the city with the housing authority, and ultimately the money to fund it came from, I believe, from HUD in Washington. That's who ultimately funded it. And the housing authority does get some of its funding from Washington. So there's multiple levels of government involved, and it's complex. I mean, they were literally expropriating what, 1,344 properties. And what was unclear in the process leading up to the actual formal state level legislation was which properties were going to be on the list and which ones would be excluded. The way eminent domain works is if your property is expropriated, you are entitled to get quote unquote fair market value for your property. Now, that's obviously a little bit subjective, but legally you're entitled to fair market value. As an example, a property with a derelict structure on it is worth more because it has a structure on it than a vacant piece of land. The idea of value is a little bit subjective, and it's kind of twisted to fit their particular formula. So this particular property that we had acquired consisted of eight properties that were assembled together, and there were structures on those properties. So if we progressed forward to, you know, move into construction by demolishing what was there, we would have in fact temporarily destroyed value, even though we were actually getting closer to our end goal.
Okay. I'm starting to see the dilemma that you were facing here. Now, let me ask you, what were they specifically expropriating the properties for?
They wanted to redevelop the area. So the public statement was they were going to repackage the properties into larger parcels and then put them out to bid to developers to redevelop parts of the city. This is an area that had a very large number of vacant properties. Out of the 1,344, many of them had already been condemned and were vacant land because those structures were no longer stable and had been torn down. So there was a lot of what I'll call urban wasteland. And of the 1,344, I think only a little over 70 of them were owner-occupied. So even then, the number of people displaced was very, very small. And most of the properties were either held by investors or maybe next of kin of people who had died. So the ownership mix was quite varied, but very few people were actually affected in terms of being displaced by their home, displaced out of their homes.
So of the properties that were owned by someone and not condemned or abandoned, they were owned by investors for the most part.
Correct.
And so what the state wanted to do was they wanted to grab up all of these properties and distribute them back out to developers to redevelop the land.
Correct.
Understood. And so this is happening, and the dilemma you're facing is, okay, well, fair market value with a structure is X, and fair market value without a structure is significantly less than X. So should we wait until they decide they're taking this property and take whatever? And talk us through, you know, what was the difference in value there and what really created that pause? You know, what were some of the thoughts going through your mind at that point?
Well, the first is that we were using investor monies to complete these projects. So we felt very strongly that we didn't want to put any investor monies at risk. And by moving forward, if we were uncertain whether the city was going to take the property or not, we really just didn't feel comfortable, quote unquote, destroying value, even though we'd be furthering the project if the city ultimately took the property. So that's why we said, all right, let's wait and see whether the properties are ultimately going to get taken or not. And by the way, when we started, it wasn't just this particular parcel that was at risk. There were quite a few. In fact, we put together a presentation. I remember working till about 3 a.m, and we produced a list of all of the properties that we owned, and we mapped out the properties that the city already owned, in many cases right next door to us. And what we did is we proposed to the city. We went down to City Hall and we proposed to the city. We said, well, if you want to take these properties over here, why don't you take those? Because they're already next to things that you own. It'll facilitate your land assembly. Here's what we're planning to build. And we'd appreciate it if you'd leave us alone over here because we're actually helping you anyway. So let us get our job done and we'll help you over here. You know, they took the input and they, in the end, that's virtually exactly what they did. But they couldn't tell us that that's what they were going to do for, you know, close to a year. So we really had a year of uncertainty at that point.
And so that costs you a lot of time. As you're looking at this, and I don't know if this will fit into our kind of traditional model here, but if we're moving to toward a black flag, the decision that you're making at this point is let's wait and see.
Exactly. It was wait and see.
And so there comes a point to where you realize that wait and see is not the best decision and it's costing you lots of money. Take us to that realization.
That realization, frankly, has only come very recently, close to 3 years into the process. So there were multiple steps along the way here. So, you know, we made the presentation. The first inkling we had of this was in January of 2015. We started the project in the fall of 2014. So by January of 2015, there were already public consultations and hearings about this eminent domain. In March, we presented to the city, and then by June, the city had passed the ordinance, and in October of 2015, the state-level legislation passed. So in October 2015, we now say, okay, good, we know what we need to do, let's move forward. We knew that we had lost 3 out of the 8 properties on this particular parcel. That left us with 5. We had developed a plan to build 10 apartments that were comprised of 5 duplexes side by side. And we chose that particular structure because when you build duplexes, you have no common elements. So you don't have to heat the stairways. You don't need a third meter, or you don't need any meters for the electricity for the common elements. So that minimized our common element expense and put all of the utilities in the hands of the tenants. So that's why we chose that particular design. Where we got stuck is after that year of delay, our construction costs had gone up significantly in a year. You know, in 2014, we had been building very routinely in Philadelphia, a good quality, you know, B-plus product at $88 a square foot. And by the fall of 2015, we had a situation where our cost was now sitting up around $105, $106 a square foot. And that increase in construction cost meant that with the rents we projected to get, the project was no longer viable. It would be too expensive to build.
Just some quick napkin math here says for a, you know, if the average size was 1,000 square feet, you could build it for $88,000. And then a year later, it's costing you $105,000. And that's a significant difference. That's, you know, I'm not a great mathematician here, but I think that's about $17,000. And that, you know, that makes a difference.
It makes a difference. It really does.
You're realizing now, that you should have gone ahead with the construction, hindsight being 2020, of course.
Correct.
Take us to the white flag here. What did you decide to actually do with this project?
We sat down with our team. We sat down with our architects. We actually fired our architect and hired another architect who had a bright idea. It turns out that the density we could get, it was limited by the zoning. And under the zoning, the square footage calculation based on the land limited us to 10 units. And if we could get higher density on that same property, we could, in fact, make the project viable again. It turns out there is a different density calculation that you're eligible for if the building would have a green roof. Now, you say, what's a green roof? It literally is a green roof. You put grass on your roof. You put a lawn on your roof. And then you're eligible for higher density. So we said, okay, that sounds like a good idea. So we decided to throw away the original design. We'd spent tens of thousands of dollars on all the engineering. We had full construction drawings. This was really shovel ready. We threw that away and said, we're going to start again with a completely new concept and put 13 units on that same footprint, but not as duplexes, but do it as a single monolithic building with common elements, hallways, and all of that kind of stuff. Storage and parking for bikes and all of that as a single building with 13 units. And that meant the units would be smaller. We'd get more rent per square foot, and that made the project viable again, in spite of the increase in the cost of construction.
If you've spent your life looking for the perfect investment, then look no further. Real estate investor, serial entrepreneur, and co-host of How to Lose Money, Paul Moore, has written his second book on real estate investing. It's called The Perfect Investment: Create Enduring Wealth from the Historic Shift to Multifamily Housing. It's available on Amazon or at his website, wellingscapital.com.
You know, I'm no construction expert, but I've never heard of that. It sounds like a fairly bizarre and obscure exception that you might have even been lucky to find. Have you ever heard of anything like that before? Or was it just somebody came to you with this idea and you thought, okay, that if that works, let's do it.
It was exactly that. We had not heard of it either, and we I really almost consider it a loophole in the zoning. It's not a loophole, it's a rule, and we're simply playing by the rules. By threading the needle through the various constraints and rules, we were able to get this higher density.
Josh, are you saying you don't have grass on your roof?
I do not have grass on my roof, and I don't know that I've seen a building with grass on the roof, or maybe I have, I'm not sure. Have you ever seen a building with grass on the roof?
Well, I have been to Austin, and I see people smoking grass on the roof.
you know, after doing 80-something, however many podcasts with Paul, I have resigned myself to never knowing what he's going to say next.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. It is a gift, sir, and you are blessed with it. Let me just kind of wrap this story up and ask you, The difference of that year, obviously you found a way to make the project viable.
Right.
But if you had to estimate what waiting ultimately costs you and you had to put a number on that, what would that be?
Just in holding costs alone, we spent about $45,000. We had to throw out another $35,000-$40,000 in architecture and engineering work from the original plan. Just between those two elements alone, that's close to $80,000 that we really are not going to get any return for as such.
Yeah, just for waiting.
Yeah, just for waiting, yeah. Not to mention the increase in cost of construction, which I haven't even factored in. That's just the money we threw away.
So I'm curious, the 13-unit building, you know, I'm in apartments too, and, you know, I don't build them anymore. I did that once, but I'm curious what the cost of construction is now per unit versus the $88 before.
Right now, we've got a lot of buildings under construction. We just finished one, a 9-unit in June, that, by the way, is fully leased. And that building we did at, I think, 105 a square. We've got an 11-unit building that should finish in the next couple of weeks. And that came in, I think, at around 106. We've got another 9-unit that should be completing also within the next month, and that's coming in also in that range, 105, 106. So this project, I'm guessing, might be a bit higher, especially now that there's going to be demand big demand for construction materials, both in Florida and in Texas. So that's going to push material costs up. So maybe we'll be at 110, maybe 115. I don't know. We'll see.
You know, I'm most curious. So you've written a book about attracting investors, getting investors for projects. You haven't talked much about your discussions with investors. How do you deal with that? What do you tell investors in a situation like this, and how did they respond so far?
Our investors have been extremely patient, and, you know, really hats off to them, because they could have been impatient and they would have been well within their rights to be impatient. So, you know, huge thank you to them for their patience. I mean, they've been understanding. They've recognized that we were moving cautiously, that our primary interest was in protecting their capital, even if that meant that things would take longer. And so we were just, you know, very open with them every step of the way, letting them know what was going on. And, you know, they're still with us. So that's a great thing.
We, you know, we partner with accredited investors to buy Class B value-add multifamily ourselves, and we've found that there's a big difference between having an investor who's accredited and has millions of dollars, and this is a small part of their portfolio, versus somebody who this is what they were counting on to live on. Have you found that, and how do you deal with that?
Absolutely. You know, one of the things, and I write about this extensively in the book Magnetic Capital, is making sure that when you're taking money from somebody that there's a fit. You know, the way that I think about it is that, investor monies have some goals and objectives. The monies have an agenda, so to speak. And if the goals for the project and the goals for the money don't match, then don't take the money. I mean, the most anxious money I ever took in my career as an investor was from an individual who only had a small amount of money to invest. I think he had about 20,000, and he really, really, really wanted to invest. And I said, what am I going to do with 20,000? Like, it's not enough to do anything with. So we said, okay, fine. We're going to put it, we'll put a mortgage on a property that we just acquired. We're going to develop it. And, you know, you're going to help us with that one property. And we bought this property, you know, distressed. Now, I think we wrote a 9-month note on the, on his 20,000. About 6 months in, he says, you know what? I want my money back. My family wants to build, wants me to go buy a property in South Asia. And so I need the money for that. And every step along the way, he was the most nervous investor. And, you know, he was calling and he was anxious, and I wish I had never taken his money. So we found another way to capitalize the project and gave him his money back. But it taught me a huge lesson that the unsophisticated investor often doesn't know what it is that they really want their money for. And I'd rather work with sophisticated investors who have great clarity on what fits and what doesn't. And, you know, the analogy that I use is it's kind of like a pair of shoes. You know, you can go to the shoe store and you can find the most beautiful pair of shoes, and my God, it's your lucky day. They're on sale this week. But if they don't fit, you're not a buyer. And the person who goes out and buys a pair of shoes without even trying them on is likely to end up with shoes that don't fit. The more sophisticated investor is really very clear on what fits and what doesn't. And, you know, they have 9 or 10 criteria, and it's not enough to meet 6 out of 10 or 9 out of 10. You got to meet them all. And if you don't meet them all, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
And so I agree with you. I prefer to work with sophisticated investors.
Thanks for sharing that. That was very clear and very helpful. And so I wish I would have heard that 10 years ago when I started raising money for other projects, because sometimes I would end up, you know, like a little bit offended. Like, wait, you don't want to invest in our project? We're friends. And I wish I would have heard that then, but thank you for sharing that now. So, and that's very well stated in your book as well. I do encourage people to get the book, Magnetic Capital. But right now we're going to transition to a segment called Failing Forward. And Victor, I'm going to ask you a series of questions and you can answer each one briefly in a sentence or two. You ready?
I'm ready.
All right. So bottom line. This is a really difficult story to hear as somebody who's involved in real estate development myself, but you had high hopes in the fall of 2014, and they were dashed not long after, by January or certainly by the summer of 2015. Bottom line, why did this failure experience happen to you?
I think we were trying to be overly cautious. And, you know, one of the things that I do, and I know this is one of your subsequent questions, is, you know, who do you turn to for help? I have an amazing mentor. His name is George Ross. You might remember him from the TV show The Apprentice as Donald Trump's advisor. And George, I think, is singularly responsible for a lot of the wealth that's been created in the Trump organization. He's really the man behind the scenes that put it together and made it all work. And even before he worked for Donald, you know, he worked for Saul Goldman, for Goldman and DiLorenzo in New York, and he did over 700 deals for them. So here's a guy with like 60 years of experience. And I run questions like this by George and ask him what I should do. And when it comes to eminent domain, he has a lot of experience with it. He was very clear. He said, Victor, don't worry about eminent domain. He said, I know a lot of people that have made tons of money through the eminent domain process. And you know what? I didn't follow his advice. So that's why I experienced the failure, is I didn't follow his advice. He was urging me to push forward, and I said, I'm going to hang back a little bit and see what happens. And that's ultimately what cost me.
I don't think we've heard that before, Josh. That's interesting. So the bottom line failure happened to you because you didn't listen to your highly experienced mentor.
Correct.
What's the single most important lesson you learned from this, Victor?
Probably that is to listen to my mentors. And even if I'm not certain myself. Maybe I needed to go back to George and dig deeper and say, you know, here's what I'm thinking of, here's what I'm worried about, and then really get to the bottom of it. Because I went against my mentor, a guy who's way more experienced than me. I really should have listened to him.
Victor, how do you protect yourself? I think I hear it coming. I hesitate to ask the question, but how do you protect yourself from failing in this way again?
I still talk to George every couple of weeks. You know, we have a monthly mastermind call. These days, I ask him more questions than ever. I even ask him questions where I think I know the answer, and he often surprises me with some insight that I certainly didn't have. But it's not just George. I do talk to other developers. I talk to other folks that are very experienced. And as my ecosystem of relationships has expanded and, you know, I'm hanging out with other developers that are, you know, doing the same types of things that I am, we're able to compare notes. I'm able to learn from their mistakes, much like, you know, when you interview people, the process of learning is not from the successes, and that's why your podcast is kind of failure-centric. It's to learn from those mistakes. I bounce everything off of other people that are either as experienced or more experienced or just have different experience.
The next question would have been, as you said, who do you turn to when you need help? And we know you turn to George Ross and other mentors. I think our audience, and I would certainly love to hear, how do you get a mentor like that? And tell us about how you came across George Ross.
He's extraordinary. You know, I met George, I'm going to say it was 2011 at an event in New York City. And my family's originally from Manhattan. My parents lived in Manhattan. My mother was an architect in New York City, one of the first women architects in existence. She was the second woman in history to actually graduate in architecture from Cornell University. And she worked on buildings that are landmark properties. So for one of the Donald Trump's very first project was the Commodore Hotel next to Grand Central Station. It's now the Grand Hyatt. That was Donald's first project, and George worked with him on that particular project. My mother designed the neighboring building, which is the Pan Am building, now the MetLife building, which sits right on top of Grand Central Station. So, you know, we just started to develop a bit of a relationship. My business coach had started this idea of a monthly mastermind call with George, and then he got bored with it. So I took over chairing the call, and we did that for like 4 years. And when you talk to the guy once a month for 4 years, you develop a relationship. And, you know, we took a pause from it. And then about a year and a half ago, I restarted. I called George up. I said, you know, let's get this going again. And we did some events together and we restarted the mastermind. And I pinched myself. I'm just so blessed to be able to call him up anytime and get advice. And what happens is when people, you know, this is a subscription series. So we have about 20 people that participate in the monthly mastermind. And they get to ask their questions of George directly. We record all the calls so people can go back and review what he said. And it's extraordinary. It's just unbelievable the quality of input we get from a man who's 89 years old. He's going to be 90 in January, and he is sharper than most 40-year-olds that I know.
So, I mean, are you still taking people for that group? I'm sure some of our listeners would like to know.
We are. We want to keep it small. You know, we can't have 300 people on a call like that. That's not going to work. But for folks that really want to learn from someone of that caliber, and by the way, I got to say this, whatever you may think of the man in the White House, put that aside. This is nothing to do with politics, nothing to do with anything with the name Trump in it. This is a man who has done more deals in New York City than anyone else alive today. He is one of the greatest deal makers of all time. And that's who I'm learning from. And that's amazing.
So what advice, Victor, would you give to someone else who finds themselves in a similar position to where you were, say, in October of 2015, faced with this decision to press forward or wait?
I would definitely talk to other developers who had gone through eminent domain with the city, with the state, and see how they handled it. I would talk to zoning attorneys. I would talk to attorneys who specialize in eminent domain and get their opinion. After having gone through this a few times with the city moves slower, at glacial speed, slower than you could ever imagine in your wildest dreams. And here's the kicker. We are now almost 2 years past the eminent domain date. We have an agreed buyout price with the city, and they have yet to put a check in our hands. We had a settlement date on May the 8th. They blew past that. We had a court date on June 20th. They blew past that. they still don't have a check in our hands, and it's 2 years later. It's amazing.
So, Victor, tell us a little bit more about your book, Magnetic Capital. I know that Paul is a big fan. I've yet to read it myself, but I'm going to make sure and pick up a copy. Who should read this, and what should they expect to get out of it?
What I discovered, and one of the main reasons I developed the intellectual property that's in this book, is, you know, after raising money in technology and then in real estate, I recognized that there was a formula that when you met the five principles of raising money, it was actually extraordinarily easy. And when you had one or more of those elements missing, raising money became very hard. And I developed this formula. It shows you very clearly what you need to do, where you've got gaps, and as soon as you understand that, you know what you need to do. It's that simple. So for anyone who is looking to raise capital, and that's like almost everybody in real estate, I think it'll help you tremendously.
Well, it certainly is bedside reading for Paul. Appreciate you sharing that with me. And do you remember you have some kind of training program or a website where people can learn more about you?
Yes. So people can connect with me at my website at victorjm.com. They can join the conversation in Facebook in the Magnetic Capital group. Or if they want to reach out to me directly, I'm happy to connect with your listeners directly. You can email me directly at victor@victorjm.com.
Very good. Well, I appreciate that. You got a new fan in me because the influence that you've been surrounded by, the lessons that you've learned, and the experience that you've had, I can certainly tell there are heaps of lessons that I can learn from you immediately. And so we're going to wrap up for today, and I really appreciate you sharing this with me. I want to just give a quick shout out to the Magnetic Capital book. You can pick that up on Amazon. Is that right, Victor?
Yes, you can pick it up on Amazon. You can pick it up directly from the website. If you want an autographed copy, order it from the website, because if it ships from Amazon, it doesn't go through me, so I can't sign it. But if you want an autographed copy, order it from victorjm.com or from Amazon, or it's also available on Kindle and soon to be in audiobook form as well.
Any final thoughts for our audience before we go?
The biggest piece of wisdom I can hope to impart is that, you know, rookie investors often tend to be very deal focused. It's all about the deal, the deal, the deal, and it's never about the deal, because a good deal badly managed is not a deal. And it always comes down to the management. That's the only differentiator out there. It's never about the deal, because the deals are everywhere. It's like an all-you-can-eat buffet. Focus on the quality of your team. And if you've got a great project and a great team with a great track record, raising the money is going to be fairly easy.
Very good. So, Victor, thanks very much for joining us. For those who enjoyed this story and it had an impact on you, we invite you to learn more about Victor Menashe at victorjm.com and pick up a copy of his book, Magnetic Capital. To our listeners, thank you very much for joining us. We recommend that you also go to howtolosemoney.com and be sure to subscribe so that you can get access to all of our latest episodes. Until next time, remember this: failure is a fact of life. Whether or not it defines you is a personal choice.
Thanks, Josh. Thanks, Victor. Goodbye, everybody. We'll see you here next time at How to Lose Money.
You've been listening to How to Lose Money. To ensure that you never miss an episode, subscribe to the show on iTunes or your favorite podcast player. Have something you want to share? Send us your comments, stories, and suggestions to howtolosemoney.com, and we'll consider them for a future episode. Until next time.